From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. When Rich Cohen was 10 years old in the late 1970s, he heard the strains of the Rolling Stones' Honky Tonk Woman for the first time. He was hooked, developing a lifetime obsession with the band. He eventually got the chance to cover the Stones as a reporter for Rolling Stone magazine. For 2 weeks, in 1994, he followed Mick, Keith, Charlie, and Ronnie on the Voodoo Lounge Tour, getting a backstage view of the self-proclaimed greatest rock and roll band in the world. He joins us in the studio in this hour to talk about his new book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. That, of course, is the Rolling Stones singing perhaps their best-known song of all. No perhaps about it. It is indeed probably their best-known sound of all. Satisfaction. Rich Cohen is the co-creator of the HBO series Vinyl. He's also contributing editor to Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone magazine. And he's written a book about the Rolling Stones. We should say right off that one of his fondest memories as a journalist was when he spent 2 weeks touring with them as a young music writer, got an insider's look into the lives of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards particularly, and that's the topic of his most recent book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, which is a social, cultural, and personal history of, well, perhaps the greatest band of all time. Welcome, Rich Cohen.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and let's talk first about that song, because there's some fascinating wrinkles to, just the whole story of the song. It's hard to pin down when it happened, but it goes back to 1965, and Keith Richards was asleep. Maybe he was a medium or something, but that's the important element here. He was asleep.
Right. Well, Satisfaction is one of those songs you hear it so much you kind of can't hear it anymore. It's like you can't see the Grand Canyon kind of thing, so one of the things we're trying to do is sort of give these songs back, and that song has this great famous backstory where Keith Richards used to sleep with a Philips tape recorder by his side and an acoustic guitar, and he woke up one morning and the guitar had been moved and the tape had been played or recorded over, and he went back and played it, and there was that riff that you're hearing very nakedly done, and he realized it was he himself playing in the middle of the night. He woke up and he'd done it, which is sort of like a great almost metaphor for artistic creation in general. He didn't even remember doing it. And he always said, on the best occasions, you serve as a medium for the song to sort of pass through you. And he wrote down this phrase, can't get no satisfaction, which Mick Jagger later said he probably nicked unintentionally from the Chuck Berry song 30 Days, which has the line, can't get no satisfaction from the judge. He gave it to Jagger. Jagger wrote the rest, including all the lyrics. And the lyrics were sort of seen as almost like a kind of a version of a Bob Dylan song. Bob Dylan writing these totally new kind of songs. His record, Bringing It All Back Home, came out that year. And then they went on tour of the United States and they worked on it. And famously, they sort of put it together at the Fort Harrison Hotel, which is now a headquarters for Scientology in Florida, by the swimming pool. And they recorded the first version at Chess Records in Chicago, where, you know, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Chuck Berry, Willie Dixon had done all their songs, which is a great influence on the Stones. And that was almost a folk song, and they were going to throw it out, but their manager insisted they stick with it because of that riff, and they kept goofing with it. They brought it to RCA Records in L.A., and then their piano player, Ian Stewart, bought this fuzz box from a local music store, and Keith Richards plugged into it, and there's the sound.
And there is a song that became an anthem. We get the usual kind of wonderful detail from you on this and the backstory. It's also, in many people's minds, not necessarily their greatest song, but the song that clearly made them. In fact, Jagger told you they absolutely needed that song. They couldn't. They could maybe get blasé about it, but it wouldn't have happened. That is, the Stones wouldn't have managed to rise if it hadn't been for that song.
America is based on the hit. You need a hit. The Constitution was the first great hit. That's how I see it. Or the Declaration of Independence. So the Stones needed a hit, and the Beatles were established, and it was unclear, you know, because there's sort of, there's always two. There's Pepsi and there's Coke, and there's Marlboro and there's Cool. And after Satisfaction, it was clear it was going to be the Beatles or the Stones. It wasn't going to be the Beatles or the Who or the Beatles or the Kinks. But that was unclear before that. And that's what Jagger said, which is you need that one song that sort of carries everything else. And for the Stones, it was Satisfaction. And not that it was such a huge commercial hit, which it was, but also that it sort of established the identity of the Rolling Stones as kind of nasty and evil and the anti-Beatles. And everything else follows from that template.
What I am always struck by in that is, I know you know a lot of the literature about the Stones and the Beatles. There was a writer named John McMillan who wrote a parallel biography of both, and we had him on the program here. And he was talking about how, well, the Beatles started out as kind of bad boys, and then they became, you know, the nice lads. The Stones started off as maybe more square and became, well, would-be working class heroes and followers of Satan or whatever.
Well, they didn't, you know, they were just trying to be a blues band. They were sort of a fake blues band, a version of a Chicago blues band, and suddenly the Beatles hit. And it's sort of like, what are you going to do? They thought it had been sort of done. It was a disaster for them. And there was this big rush for the new Beatles. And there were a lot of bands that came up. And slowly they got this manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, who realized because they were not good looking like the Beatles. They were kind of ugly and their music was kind of rough, that there was a niche for them. You know, as Keith Richards said, when we showed up, the Beatles were wearing the black hats. So what did that leave us? And there was this niche in the market, which was sort of evil. And you read, you know, the early songwriting by Jagger and Richards, the songs didn't fit for the Rolling Stones. Songs like As Tears Go By that they gave to Marianne Faithfull. And it took actually, weirdly, the Beatles, Lennon and McCartney, to write the first Rolling Stones song because they understood what they were, maybe because they were more like that themselves. And they wrote I Want to Be Your Man, which was the Stones' second single and the first kind of real Rolling Stones song. And it took the Stones a bunch of months longer before they figured out what they were and how to write it. And then you can follow it very clearly that they have songs like Play With Fire and, you know, Sympathy for the Devil, all the way up to Altamont. They're playing with this idea of evil that really starts almost as a marketing thing.
Well, Altamont really did put them on the map in terms of being associated with violence. And yet, as you violence that they weren't necessarily directly involved in, but bringing up the Hell's Angels and all the rest of that and a death, really, that resulted from violence. But you've got, for example, accounts. I remember, in fact, you mentioned Chuck Berry. I remember when Chuck Berry punched Keith Richards. But you talk about Mike Dorsey, a British actor, punching out Brian Jones, and in fact, get into their character to a great degree. Brian Jones, for example, was not such a good character, to put it mildly. In fact, wasn't he referred to in all kinds of pejorative ways, by members of the band?
Absolutely. I mean, Brian Jones sort of is the guy who started the Rolling Stones. People always look for the moment the Stones began, and they always say it's when Keith Richards and Mick Jagger ran into each other, Jagger carrying all these Chess records on the train station in England in Dartford. To me, it's the moment that Brian Jones, who is a little guy from a little town in England, first heard Elmore James and heard his slide guitar. And then he started playing slide guitar, only guy in England to play slide guitar. And then Richards and Jagger saw him and were completely blown away by him. And it was that sort of moment that the Rolling Stones came out of. It was Brian Jones's band. He basically brought in Jagger and Richards and some other people. He picked the name. He set the songs. But he had a kind of a personality disorder. He was he started to lose control of the band, which he did when they started to become bigger because, you know, people focus on the lead singer. It's just the way it is because the lead singer is the voice of the band for people to latch onto. And he started to lose control of the Stones then. And then when Satisfaction came out, and suddenly commercially it was Jagger and Richards controlling what the content of the band was, he started to act out in all kinds of ways, and he really became a guy that had to be dealt with. And to me, sort of one of the great set pieces of rock and roll is, you know, 1969, not long at all before Altamont, was sort of in a way sets up the whole thing when Mick Jagger and Keith Richards go up to Brian Jones's country house, which was the house where A.A. Milne wrote Winnie the Pooh. And Brian Jones had kind of become Winnie the Pooh, and they fired him, you know. And it's almost like a scene from The Godfather. It's like, and he died 2 days after that, and he was, you know, he was 27 years old. He was a charter member of the 27 Club, all the rock stars that died at 27. So in a way, Brian Jones is sort of he's the original Rolling Stone, and he created the whole image of the Rolling Stone. He had five kids before he was 27, and he named two of them Julian. And I always say that sort of gives you a sense of how much he was concentrating on his role as a father.
Well, he was also abusive of women, and he was punched out, as I said, by the British actor Mike Dorsey, as you account in your book. And also, I don't want to get too much into Brian Jones here, but the fact is he was jealous of both Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. I was also struck by something you said a minute ago, though, about Jagger being, you know, out there in the front and getting most of the attention, much more than even Richards, let alone Brian Jones. And I remember interviewing it was Wynton Marsalis, I believe, one of the Marsalis brothers, who said, you know, you see the lead singer and you think he's the whole band, but he's really, in some ways, in terms of the success of the band, maybe the least important figure.
Yeah, well, there was early on, you know, when they were doing the mix for one of the songs, they wanted Jagger's voice mixed at the same level as the instruments, because that's how the blues was. The voice was just another instrument, and the producer kept trying to turn it up, like a Frank Sinatra session, and Brian Jones snapped and said, we're not Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones, we're the Rolling Stones. And the fact is that Jagger really was the only one who didn't play an instrument, and Brian Jones really was the most talented musician in the band. But people are simple. People don't really, you know, people that aren't musicians don't necessarily know all the intricacies of what's going on with this music, and they will naturally attach to the singer because the singer seems to be delivering the message. What's so interesting about the Stones is, like, when you played Satisfaction a second ago, there's two voices there. There's the guitar, which is Keith in that case, and there's the voice, which is Jagger. And it's those two voices interwoven and playing off each other that make the Rolling Stones so powerful. It's this true mix of these different things. But, you know, the singer is the front man. There's a reason why they're called the front man, and Jagger's probably the greatest front man in the history of rock and roll.
And we're talking with Rich Cohen. Rich Cohen is the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones and contributing editor at Vanity Fair, also at Rolling Stone magazine, author of a number of books, Tough Jews, The Avengers, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead, with Jerry Weintraub, who was featured on this program, and also co-creator of the HBO series Vinyl, which we can talk about as well. But I want to get into some of the songs. You and I have You've been a passionate devotee of the Stones for quite some time, since boyhood, and we have different tastes. But you mentioned Altamont, and Altamont may have been certainly the biggest controversy that the Stones endured, but there was a lot of controversy about women, and particularly about some of the songs, like Under My Thumb. I'd like to hear just a bit of this, and then we can talk about that.
Under my thumb, the squirming dog who's just had her day.
Well, there was a lot of controversy about that song as degrading women, and some girls similarly, and Brown Sugar, and some thoughts about that from you, Rich?
Well, it just goes to the idea of being the anti-Beatles. You know, the Beatles are I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's the love, 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 love. So the Stones were positioned as sort of the opposite and the anti of that. And, you know, Tom Wolfe at the time when the Stones first came to America said the Beatles want to hold your hand and the Rolling Stones want to burn down your town. So when they delivered a record, that's how they delivered it. And they needed those songs to – it's like the brand, you know. And the thing that's interesting is if you look at the first song that they consider a real Rolling Stone song, it's the song The Last Time. The Last Time is basically a cover as far as I'm concerned. It was a staple singer song about Judgment Day. And they sort of rewrote it and rewrote the lyrics so it was about a girl's getting her comeuppance. You know, this is the last time you're going to treat me like this. And that's really the story of the Rolling Stones, which is they were playing on this blues tradition and a church tradition and turning it into this kind of secular thing and kind of this thing about sort of like revenge and love. And that's also why the church had such a problem with it. It's like they took the Hammond organ out of the church and they dragged it into the street and sang dirty songs with it.
Well, also, you know, straight, so. I mean, as you allude to Sympathy of the Devil, I mean, that was a song that certainly got a lot of the church people worked up, and really not only just church people.
Yeah, well, so they start. It started almost like a pose. That's how I always thought of it. I grew up after Altamont, so I never really took it as anything other than kind of a lark and a joke. But people took it seriously, and this idea that started with they're going to be the anti-Beatles goes from Play with Fire to I Am, you know, Sympathy for the Devil, which is interesting because it plays on this old, old blues tradition where all this music comes from, which is you're going to trade your soul to the devil for rock and roll, which is what Robert Johnson did. And Jagger sort of puts himself in that deal, but he puts himself in the position of the devil. Like, as a literary person, it's kind of fascinating, and it's a really literary song. But it got out of control. So they had the whole thing with Aleister Crowley and Kenneth Anger. And in that 69 tour that ends at Altamont, and at Altamont, Jagger's wearing a shirt that has an Omega on it, which is like a reference to the book of Revelation and from Alpha to Omega and the end time. And the way to me, that was kind of the end of that era of the Rolling Stones, because it's like every night Mick Jagger threw a party and he went dressed up as the devil. And then at the last party, the actual devil showed up.
Let's hear a little of Sympathy for the Devil.
Okay.
I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his fate. Meet you. Hope you guess my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game.
Talking with Rich Cohen about the Rolling Stones, and that's, of course, Sympathy for the Devil, which you're talking, Rich, about the literary side of the Rolling Stones as well as the major blues side. When I first heard that, I thought Esthétique du Mal, or, you know, Sympathy for the Devil is a kind of aesthetics of evil in a way.
Yeah, and the story is that Marion Faithfull was reading this Michael Bulgakov novel, Master and Margarita, which had just been translated into English and kind of became a rage in England, and he picked it up and read it. And, you know, it's just interesting because it's where it dovetails, which is one, Jagger's own image and the image of the band, plus the whole idea that rock and roll is the devil's music, and playing it in this with this very, very brilliant way. And, of course, it's almost like you feel like in those years they're kind of playing with fire, and ultimately they get burned by it. And that's the thing about Altamont that kind of really was damaging to the Rolling Stones, I think, in a way people don't acknowledge, which is Jagger on stage at Altamont and filmed by the Maisels brothers, so everybody's seen it who cares about the Rolling Stones, had to step out of that character to try to keep the situation under control. And then you saw that indeed it was just a character.
Well, it certainly was a character, but nevertheless created a great deal of controversy. And when we think about the Rolling Stones and controversy, we also think about drug use and promiscuity and really what rock and roll has always symboled in terms of its perception as being the devil's work, drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
Yeah, I always thought like a way to categorize the Rolling Stones is just by what drugs they were taking when they made the records. That'd be a good way to make a collection. And you can always tell in the song. So in the early years, they were taking amphetamines, truck driver drugs, just to stay awake. And you hear it in those songs because they're all very speedy. They're speedy songs. And then the whole idea of LSD as this mind-expanding thing, which leads to their really bad record, which is Her Satanic Majesty's Request, which is a psychedelic record, which is almost Spinal Tap. I mean, it's just a step away from being Spinal Tap. And then they always thought that, you know, the 60s was leading – or LSD in the 60s was leading to kind of Nirvana, and then they were shocked to find out it was leading to the 70s. That's when I grew up. And then you get the greatest record by the Rolling Stones, I think, which is XL on Main Street, because it's The Hangover. And it's everything that came before in one record, and now they've gone from LSD really to heroin. And these are the heroin years of Keith Richards just being, you know, sort of out of it. That what amazed me about Keith Richards' book Life, by the way, was that it was like Weekend at Bernie's told from the point of view of Bernie. You know, because when you see those records, when you see pictures, he's always like unconscious in a corner. So how did the guy write the book? But, you know, that's interesting because they're so in the front of their culture. The way I looked at this book, I thought it could be the whole history of rock and roll, because I thought rock and roll kind of died. In the mid-90s, it ended, and it was so important to a lot of us. You'd wait for that next record the way you'd wait for the new iPhone. You'd get online for it, and you'd feel like if the record was good, you had a decent chance at having a great summer. And that kind of died, and nobody has stepped back and written the big story of what it meant. And the Rolling Stones are the best vehicle for that because they're the greatest rock band who lasted.
Do you want to tell the whole story of rock and roll here then?
Absolutely. And the idea from the very beginnings of, you know, it almost starts this part of it with all these different British guys living in the ruins of England after World War II, hearing Elvis sing Heartbreak Hotel on Armed Forces Radio. Every one of them has that experience and the sort of lightning bolt of that. And then taking this American music. I grew up in Chicago. All this music really comes through Chicago and Chess Records. And I always said, like, the road from the north side of Chicago where I grew up to the south side went through England. And they brought all that music back. And then you get this incredible golden run. With the Rolling Stones, it's through their four masterpieces after the Beatles break up and they sort of find their groove. And it's just like the groove in one of the middle of their songs, which seems like it can go on forever and then ends. All the way up until Jagger and Richard sort of can't work together anymore and the music sort of disappears.
How can you say rock and roll's over when we got Coachella coming to us?
You got a lot of porta potties out in the desert. That's all I can say. So good luck with that.
Well, we've got Dylan, though. And in fact, when we were talking about Satisfaction and McCartney,
What I mean is, I'm not saying that it ended like it doesn't exist anymore. I'm saying that it became backward looking instead of forward looking.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Oh.
And the fact that this is the biggest show and it's about, you know, think about it. This music is 53 years old. Do you think in 1964 the Stones were listening to music from 1910 or 1913? I mean, it's like this moment was so big we got stuck on this one kind of page. And you still have great rock and roll bands, but I don't think anybody believes it's going to change the world the way they used to.
Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Rich Cohen. And Rich Cohen is the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. You want to say something about that title? It came from Jagger or Keith Richards. Right?
No, it came from – I got this assignment from Rolling Stone magazine to go up to Toronto and just hang out in this middle school gym where the Stones were rehearsing for their Voodoo Lounge tour. If you're ever wondering what's going on in your middle school gym in the middle of the night, in the middle of the summer, the Rolling Stones apparently are rehearsing there. And I was interviewing them, and I started asking Keith Richards questions, and he was surprised by my questions. And finally he said, "Hey, what year were you born?" And I said, 1968, which doesn't make me that young now, but made me really young then. And he just started to laugh, and he said, "You know what? You should be answering these questions for me. I don't know what it's like. For you, the Stones were always there. What's it like, you know, when there's always been the sun and the moon and the Rolling Stones?" So that's where the title comes from. That really is a perspective of me, which is I'm the little brother, man. I was lying in bed having to listen to the party downstairs and listen to the records through my brother's locked door. And I sort of showed up at the party just in time to see the last cocktail of the night with a cigarette floating in it. That's my point of view on the whole world.
Well, I'm coming up on a break here, but I wanted to mention, since you said little brother, that was what Billy Crystal in his eulogy of Ali said, that Ali called him. And you posted something on Facebook. We talked about Ali earlier last week after his death. You said something about Ali that I found very moving about your dad. And I want to get that story. But I want to invite listeners, before we go there or go anywhere else, to join us. Rolling Stones, what do they bring to mind? Toll free. Any questions, any comments? 866-733-6786. You can join us now at our toll free number, 866-733-6786. Are they the greatest rock and roll band of all time? And what's your favorite rock and roll song by the Rolling Stones? Or email us forum@kqed.org. Well, that's Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones, and that's one of the songs that I think it's safe to say is almost lionized, really, by Rich Cohen in his book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. We have considerably different tastes when it comes to the Rolling Stones. Rich, I know you like Memory Hotel and you like Waiting on a Friend. Those are not my favorites. Everybody has their own favorites, which is why I threw the question out there. I like Start Me Up, and You Can't Always Get What You Want. Much more conventional taste, probably, than you. I even like Painted Black, which is really kind of an anarchic song when you get down to it. But there's a richness and a variety, and the Stones, as you've said, really live on. I wanted to, before I go to our listeners, I wanted to get you on record about that story about Ali and your dad, because it was really a very touching story. Can you, it's better it comes from you, the source.
Sure. Well, when I was a little kid, we landed at O'Hare Airport, and my father went to get the luggage. And when he get the luggage, it was like you couldn't talk to him. It was like he was hunting big game. And he sort of sets up at the belt, and I was like about 8 years old, and I go wandering off through O'Hare Airport, and I look up, and there's Muhammad Ali. And I just said, "Hey, champ." And he sort of got down on one knee, and he goofed around with me, and he threw a bunch of fake haymakers, and he played with me for a little bit. And then I just walked back, and I saw my dad, and I said, "Hey, I just saw the champ." And he goes, yeah, get out of here. I'm waiting for the luggage. And I was sort of crestfallen, and I went wandering away again, and Ali saw me, and he said, "Hey, what's wrong? You look sad." And I said, "My dad doesn't believe that I met you." And he picked me up, and he said, "Where is he?" We went over, my dad was still at the belt. I pointed to him, and Ali tapped my father on the shoulder and held his fist up. So my father turned around. There was Muhammad Ali with his fist in his face. And he said, "Hey, my friend here says you don't believe in me."
That's a great story. Talking again with Rich Cohen. And you can join us. In fact, I invite you to do that. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, a number of ways you can communicate your thoughts, your memories about the Rolling Stones, any questions you might have. Rich has been a passionate follower since boyhood, since I guess he heard Honky Tonk Woman, and as the lyrics suggest, it blew his mind. There are also other ways of communicating with us. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. And let me go to your calls. Let's go, John, first to you. You're on. Morning.
Good morning. I just have one comment. The guest had made some crazy comment about people not listening to music from 50 years ago. However, the Rolling Stones were listening to music from the 10s and 20s and 30s. They were listening to the blues the way McCartney was listening to the music from the 20s and 30s via his father. And the English music hall tradition. So, yeah, there's always a tradition to go back to who came before.
Well, there is a lineage there. In fact, the blues go back really to the spirituals, and so does rap and all the rest of it.
But that's not what I mean. I don't mean people who are into music going back. I'm talking about popular music in the culture. You know what I'm saying? Like the Rolling Stones, if you go to a hockey game or a basketball game and you're sitting around the timeout, you're going to hear Start Me Up. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about it's still the central music in the culture. You know, Satisfaction is still out there. You still hear it on a Hilton commercial. And, of course, there's the Rolling Stones go back to the very beginning as far as what they studied, what they stole, what they learned from. I'm talking about, you know, pop music in the culture. I'd say on the radio, but there wasn't, you know, the radio in 1913. But that's what I'm talking about.
Well, what are you talking about with respect to, here, a comment from Robert, because actually the last time I saw the Stones was here in San Francisco, and they started with Start Me Up. And here's Robert, who says, "It's sad to see the Rolling Stones continue touring and lazily playing the same songs over and over with little change night to night. Contrast that with the Grateful Dead reunion, for example, where the Dead repeated only two songs in five shows."
Well, you know, it comes out of a different touring culture. When the Stones first started touring, they were on these packets. With their first tour outside of the clubs in London is they would go, you know, they went around England with like Bo Diddley and the Everly Brothers, and they'd come up and they'd play three songs. And their tour grew out of that. This sort of Springsteen idea or the Dead idea that you go on tour and these long tours and play, you know, four-hour shows, like it's completely different. And the Grateful Dead are kind of a jam band. And so I just wouldn't compare it. It's like two different things. What's amazing about the Rolling Stones is, at heart, they really are a bar band. And the people who saw them back at the very beginning, they all started bands. It's like the Velvet Underground. And it completely, you know, that's their experience of rock and roll. One of the great things I got to see when I was with them is they do these pop-up gigs before a tour where they play in a little bar with like 300 people. And Jagger can't run around and dance around because there's no room. And you see what they really are at heart, which is the greatest bar band in the history of the world. And you kind of do wish they could take that and play that, you know, for the whole world and be a band where they could play a different song every night and where they can, you know, you can yell out a request and they'd play it. But the fact is they're like a playing to 70,000 people with a giant stage set with lighting and everything. And the spontaneity is removed from a show like that.
On we go to more of your calls. Jonathan, join us. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, guys. How you doing? I'm just listening to your radio here on the way to work. And I just want to say, I just turned 22 years old, and I have been listening to the Stones ever since I was a kid with my dad and my uncle. And Rich said earlier that Rolling Stones have one of the best frontmen ever in rock and roll, Mick Jagger. And I completely agree. I just saw them in San Diego on the Zipco tour recently, about a year ago now. And I completely agree that he is one of the most rock and roll guys I've ever seen on stage. I've seen a lot of bands, and it's pretty awesome to see them at their age still doing what they're doing, and almost like they just began yesterday.
Well, thank you for those comments, Jonathan. Good to hear from a young millennial like you, and we'll hear from another listener up in North Bay. Richard, hi, you're on.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Thank you.
Hello, Rich. I just want to tell you briefly that I grew up with Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Pat's Domino and Bill Haley and the Comets, and you know, I loved rock and roll. And the first time I saw him was at the Civic Auditorium in San Francisco, probably 1965. It might have been 64, but they were playing on a bill with the Byrds and Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Vegetables. And I think it was $5 for that show. And you know, when they came out there, you know, they were dressed in sweatshirts and Levi's. These guys were like, it was like at a fraternity party, because most of the kids that were at the show that night had already left because the Stones came on last. So there were probably about 100 of us there watching the Stones. And they started with Everybody Needs Somebody to Love and did King Bee and Carol, Oh Carol, and stuff like that. And just great old Rolling Stones stuff that really made them such a great rock and roll band. But one of the last times I saw them was at Altamont. And at Altamont, that was such a horrific situation, because when they finally came into that, it was like they had walked into a portal of insanity. And people had been there since early morning because no one even knew where that concert was. And when they finally arrived there, they saw a number of bands with Starship and what. And next thing you know, they arrived, and there was this huge lull in time because the Stones, Jagger walked right by me, and that must have been around 2 o'clock, and they didn't play for hours after that. But almost in an attempt, and you were talking about Satanic Connection here, but almost in an attempt to raise the level of the ultimate crescendo, it really turned ugly.
Well, it turned ugly in large part because they decided to have the Hells Angels as their guards up there on the stage, and like you said, things were chaotic even to begin with. But I'm looking at a question here for you, Rich, apropos of what we just heard from Richard about. Well, again, a lot of this was posing and all that, satanic posing, Beelzebub, whatever. And Richard, thank you for the call. David writes, "Sympathy for the Devil is misunderstood as some kind of ode to Satan. It is much more related to Plato's idea of good and evil in every man and modern existentialism."
Well, that's a little beyond my depth. I mean, I can say that I really think it was playing with the idea of as sort of history, a way to tell history through the point of view of one of the actors in history, which is evil. And really it does come, if you read that book, Master and Margarita, you kind of really see where the inspiration comes from. One of the great things about these songs is they don't mean one thing and they're cryptic, and they really got that, you know, from literature and from Bob Dylan and stuff. So it almost sounds like it's about Jagger and his life itself. You know, the man of wealth and taste becomes Mick Jagger. And, it's interesting about Altamont, like I said, just because it was sort of the end for a whole bunch of reasons, but one of which is, he shows up dressed as the devil, and the devil is there, and it's sort of the end of the Rolling Stones. And that song, if you look at, like, Brown Sugar is a song that they played for the first time after Meredith Hunter was killed at Altamont. They continued and played a whole show. And people who were there, maybe Richard, who's off the phone now, because I'm too young, they said it was like one of the greatest Rolling Stones shows they'd ever seen, probably because they were playing under such fear and under such stress and to get out of there. You know, but if you look at their set list after the killing in Altamont, it's incredible that they went on and played that show.
Actually, Jessica asks, we do have a lot of young listeners, you can tell by this question. Could you explain what happened at Altamont? That was, she's too young to know, because it was 1969. Want to give us a brief description from your perspective, Rich?
Yeah, basically, the Rolling Stones had this 69 tour. It was not long after Woodstock, and they had this a lot of pressure on them because they were criticized in the press in San Francisco for overcharging for tickets. I forget what the price was. It was ridiculous now. It's like $7 or something. So they decided at the end of the tour, they'd had the tour, they were going to throw a free concert in, first it was, I think, you know, Golden Gate Park, and then it got moved to the Sears Speedway or something. Then ultimately it got moved to Altamont very late in the day, and very quickly they decided to put this on. And it was the era of Woodstock where kind of they didn't want police there because police were the enemy, and they, the Hell's Angels were there, and it's disputed about whether or not they were hired to guard them or just brought in so they didn't come unwanted. And the situation, they had all these bands, including the Jefferson Airplane, and Graham Parsons played there, and Santana. And the Hell's Angels just basically had a riot, and they started to beat up the Rolling Stones fans, and it sort of crescendoed when the Stones came on, I think playing Under My Thumb, which you were just playing, when a Stones fan, someone in the audience named Meredith Hunter, was stabbed and killed by one of the Hell's Angels who said he was waving a gun around. And this whole thing was filmed by the Maisels brothers and actually is on film. So you can see the gun and you can see the stabbing. And really it was this, you know, and in addition to that, it was just a big, giant, violent riot that was so different than what Woodstock had been. A lot of people said it was the end of the 60s, which the Rolling Stones themselves always dismissed and tried to just say, look, it was just a bad show. And the truth is that rock and roll riots had gone back to the very beginning. If you look at those shows Alan Freed put on way back at the beginning, there were often rock and roll riots, and the Stones often ginned up a little bit of violence because it made the shows more exciting. It's like the mosh pit at a punk show. But in this case, it just got completely out of control. And there's a really funny line that Mick Taylor, who was the Stones guitarist, said then, which is he said, yeah, it was. They asked him if it was the end of the 60s. He said, yeah, it was December 1969. So, yes, it was literally the end of the 60s.
And you mentioned, again, Brown Sugar and Under My Thumb, and getting some pushback here from a listener who writes, your guest is so incredibly clueless and lost in hero worship for the Rolling Stones that he completely managed to get around your token question about the huge issue, and she writes huge in big caps, of their degrading approach to women by just asserting that they were the anti-Beatles. So therefore, it's okay then? Got it.
It's funny because if you go look at the press around this book, I'm often described as a person who's wrote the most devastating book about the Rolling Stones and called Mick Jagger a monster, which isn't really exactly right either. So I just, as far as the Rolling Stones and women go, what do you want me to say? Those songs were very misogynistic. I mean, yes, they were, absolutely. And yes, they were playing with this idea. They were pushing limits and getting a lot of attention for doing it. And often it was only when they pushed limits that's just good sense selling records back then. And that's been true with music from the beginning too, which is, you know, rock and roll often does the best when it really pisses people off. And you can go from the Rolling Stones, you know, the Rolling Stones are the forerunner to punk. That was the amazing thing, which is the Rolling Stone rock and roll had been really dangerous at the beginning with Elvis and all and you know, even people winding up getting put in jail. And then it kind of went through this fallow period, very tame period in the United States where Buddy Holly had died. And Elvis Presley was in the army and never quite the same after the army. And Jerry Lee Lewis married his cousin or whatever he did, you know. And then suddenly back from Britain came the original dangerous, nasty, disgusting, misogynistic, hateful, but also kind of electric rock and roll energy. And that was the Rolling Stones. They were the first ad campaign is, would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone? So, I mean, I just don't have a lot to say about it, except, yes, you're absolutely right, and people loved it.
Well, in fact, we heard Wild Horses. Was it Mick Jagger who described their energy and form of their music wanting to be Wild Horses?
Yeah, well, I mean, no. So what happened with that song is a little bit later. So the Rolling Stones were about to go on the tour that ultimately culminated in Altamont. And there was a whole backstory where Brian Jones had fallen in love with this woman, Anita Pallenberg. Then Anita Pallenberg had basically been treated very badly by Brian and left Brian and went off with Keith Richards and became kind of the love of his life. And then she made the performance, the movie Performance, in which she was involved in sex scenes with Mick Jagger.
I mean, this is what makes him so interesting. The backstory is absolutely crazy. It's a soap opera, you know, and there was a big trouble between them, and they sort of got it all back together, and they were at home, and their son was born, was named Marlon, was born a year after me. And Keith wrote this song, Wild Horses, just the beginning, and the phrase, Wild Horses Couldn't Drag Me Away, because he didn't want to leave this moment of domestic perfection in England. He gave it to Jagger, and Jagger sort of rekeyed the whole thing to be about his girlfriend, who was merry and faithful, who'd attempted to commit suicide, had been in a coma, and now was leaving Jagger. And he made it about her, according to this. To
and him. Then fast forward, Loren Scott, Jagger's girlfriend, who did commit suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole weird trajectory there, and it's labyrinthine if you try to set, get through it. But just wondering, when you talk about Mick Jagger as being a monster, a listener writes here, what does your guest think of vinyl? I really like how edgy and unpredictable it is, and maybe we can talk about it for a moment. But you had to work with Jagger on that, didn't you?
Yeah, Jagger's great to work with. It's just, you know, when you write a book, you get deep into the whole history of somebody. You look at the fact, you know, of Brian Jones and his death and the fact that Mick Jagger didn't go to Brian Jones's funeral. You know, you look at you talk to Marianne Faithfull and you hear what she has to say, and you sort of grapple with it. And it's kind of the Tom Wolfe thing, which is it's sort of a man in full, you know, in that there's good and there's bad. And the attempt is to write about these people like they're actual historical figures, and you try to include it all. And the backstory to the songs is in the songs. That's what gives the songs such richness, is you feel like you're getting a little glimpse into their lives with each other. And it's interesting because you look at Keith, and for whatever went out on the road, you know, Mick Jagger had all these girlfriends and all the stories. Keith was sort of like a serial monogamist. He has long-term relationships and only a few really important relationships in his life. And you really get the sense that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, together since their kids, are so different and are involved in such a fight. And that fight is captured on vinyl, and that's what gives the Stones their real engine.
And we bring more of our callers on. Chris, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. So I was calling. I heard your guest's story about, you know, his father not believing about meeting Muhammad Ali. And I have a similar story. It's in the reverse, though. My father was attending law school at UCLA in the 70s, and he was good friends with Peter Lopez, who later became an attorney for Michael Jackson and others. But Peter at the time was dating the West Coast tour manager, or someone involved with the Rolling Stones tour operation on the West Coast. My dad told me the story about how he and Peter went to pick up Keith Richards at the hotel, at the airport, and went back to the hotel. And then he went partying with the Stones backstage. And you know, I hear this story as like 13, 14-year-old, and I'm thinking, yeah, right, Dad, okay, whatever. And so he sits me down, he pulls out his Kodachrome, you know, the slides, and we're clicking through it, and there he is backstage with the Stones. You know, there's John Lennon, there's Aretha Franklin, and I'm thinking, my God, I can never doubt my dad again.
That's funny.
That's a good story.
You really shouldn't.
Yeah, thanks.
You know,
Chris.
It's weird. It's one of the things that I thought was so interesting about the Stones' subject matter is that they really did cross the paths of everybody, and everybody, a lot of people doing really interesting things. And if you tell their story properly, you tell the story of all these other people, and you tell the story of this whole era.
Here's
and
Eric.
It's amazing, you know.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, finish your thought, Rich. I thought you.
It's just amazing how many different lives they've touched.
This is a listener locally who writes about the Stones. It kind of dovetails. The history of the Stones, Eric writes, is very connected to San Francisco Bay Area. Bill Graham Presents promoted a number of their concerts and tours. Winterland, the Dog Patch T-shirt supplier, printed a lot of their merchandise, and FM Productions in Brisbane built many of their elaborate stage sets for tours like Steel Wheels, etc. It would be great to hear from some people who worked at these businesses. I don't know if it's still on, but the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco had an exhibit about Bill Graham, and there were pictures, of course, of him with just about everybody, including the Stones. But early on, I think his heart was a little bit broken by Jagger and the Stones because they elected, for whatever reason, not to work with him or not to continue working with him.
And he was very critical of them on that 69 tour, and he accused them a lot. And he's one of the people that said they were overcharging. And it's interesting, though, because when I did the first stories about them, because I did a few of them for Rolling Stone, it really was a business story. And I approached it from that angle. So I did interview, you know, the people who built the stages, and Michael Cole was their promoter. And because by that point in 1994, when I was first with them, they'd become, you know, everyone looks at them as the greatest band or not, depending on your opinion. But they'd also become this huge multi-million, possibly billion-dollar corporation. And that is also what they are. And to go on tour with them, which I did that summer, was really unbelievable because it's like Barnum and Bailey's times a million. And you really see that at the core of it, it's a billion-dollar business.
Here's a caller who was at Altamont. Douglas, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I had worked a little bit for Bill Graham and doing gopher stuff for Chet Helms at the Avalon, but in 1969, I decided I'd hitchhike around the country, and I ended up working at the West Palm Beach Pop Festival, and that was one of the shows the Stones did on that tour, and they invited me to come back and work at the Altamont show as well. So I caught a little bit of that era, and I just I agree with some of the other people's comments that it actually musically it was a great show, but the vibes were so strange that day that I kind of gave up that life and I went back to Berkeley and finished my degree. I just thought I would throw that in there.
Glad you threw it. Douglas, we thank you. And here's somebody else on Altamont. Doug writes, this is kind of a funny correction. He says, just a small correction. The guest said that at the Altamont concert, Jagger was wearing a shirt with an Omega. I was at Altamont on acid, unfortunately, but the symbol on Jagger's shirt was the astrological sign for Leo, which is what Jagger is.
He was wearing an Omega. I was talking about throughout the 69 tour. You know, it's sort of like all these little almost dog whistle symbols of Satanism, because at that time they were hanging out with, it wasn't really them. It was more their girlfriends, the whole Kenneth Anger wanted to make a movie with them, and they were reading Aleister Crowley. And it wasn't just the Stones either. It was Led Zeppelin too. And there was this idea, you know, that it was sort of the devil's music. And the Beatles never, as far as I know, I'm not an expert on the Beatles, but the Beatles never really got into that. And it was interesting, you know, and it added this other texture to the music. And now it sort of seems a little bit silly because no one really believes Mick Jagger is or ever was Lucifer. I don't. But if you go back and read what was being written at the time, even by people like Patti Smith, who when she was a kid wrote a lot about him, there really was a sense that they were touching upon this sort of dark, you know, power, Mick and Keith. And I just feel like Altamont is where it finally boils over.
And here's Todd. Todd, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guest if he feels like there are people that maybe gravitate towards the era of the Brian Jones era of the Rolling Stones, or gravitate towards the Mick Taylor era of the Rolling Stones, because I know that for myself, I gravitate more towards the early 70s into mid 70s, even late 70s, Mick Taylor era. And I'm wondering if he's found like that's kind of a division of how people like the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it partly explains why the Rolling Stones are so successful. Because early on, their manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, said, if you want to last as a band, and it's good for everything, you got to kind of reinvent yourself every 5 years, because that's how long it takes a kid from being a sophomore in high school to being out in the world. And now you have a new sophomore in high school who wants his own band. And the Rolling Stones did that. And one way they did that was by having different lead guitarists that totally really changed the sound of the band. So you'll meet people depending on when they were in high school. It's like, who's your favorite cast of Saturday Night Live? It's usually going to be the cast from when you were in high school. And it's the same with the Stones. Your favorite band is usually the band that existed when you were in high school. And in the early 60s, you know, it was Brian Jones. And that band had a really distinct sound. And Brian Jones was a great musician with a distinct, unusual sound. And then you get the Mick Taylor, who's there for those great years. And he has that very melodic, it's a completely different sound. And then Ron Wood. And their last really great album as the Rolling Stones, in my opinion, and one of the greatest albums, which is Some Girls. So you sort of have three different versions of the Rolling Stones, and your favorite is probably going to depend on how old you are.
We actually just got a call from a listener named Judy who said she was at Altamont, keeps coming up here. She was 19. Jagger came out at sunset with a cape on, and he was singing The Big Night Rambler, and she said it was amazing. Let me bring another caller on here quickly. Steven, that's you. Good morning.
Hey, I just want to quickly first off, thanks for the show. Secondly, just a quick memory that kind of about the enduringness of Stones fandom. My friend Pat and I used to stay up really late when we were, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, just listening to the Stones, talking about the Stones, reading passages from Ups and Downs of the Rolling Stones. And here we are pushing 50, both of us. And whenever we get together, once the kids are in bed and the wife's asleep, we're sitting in front of the stereo listening to the Stones, talking about the Stones. And I guarantee you we'll be doing it from our wheelchairs when we get into our 80s.
Transgenerational. And your kids maybe by osmosis take some of that too and carry it on just like it's done. With, as many have pointed out, the Grateful Dead. Thank you for that call. I'm looking at a quick question here, Rich. Any truth, Bob wants to know, to the rumor that Clapton and the Stones were in a studio together? Do you know?
Actually, but it wasn't just Clapton. It was a bunch of people, Al Cooper. And there, I think is what they're referring to is there's another version of Brown Sugar. Brown Sugar was, I think, made in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, the version we know. But for Keith Richards' birthday, they recorded it. They had a big party. And they in the Olympic Studios in London, I think it was Keith's birthday. I'd have to check my own book. My memory's not always perfect. And they recorded this almost live in the studio version of Brown Sugar. And Clapton was there. I think George Harrison was there. And recently, I think they finally released it when they did the re-release of Sticky Fingers. And you can actually hear it. So, yes, Clapton was in. And there was even talk of Clapton replacing Mick Taylor as the lead guitarist of the Stones, and it was between Clapton and Ron Wood. And Clapton said to Ron Wood, I'm a better guitar player than you. And Ron Wood said, yeah, but you got to also live with these guys, and you can't do that, and I can.
So, yeah, Rich Ron. Cohen, again, is the author of The Sun, the Moon, and the Rolling Stones. We're going out with Waiting for a Friend. You want to say Waiting on a Friend. You want to say something about it while we go out?
It's just one of the greatest Rolling Stones songs. It was recorded years before it was released, I think, on Goat's Head Soup. And at the end of it, you hear this great sax solo. That's actually Sonny Rollins.
Thank you, Rich.
Charlie Watts brought in.
Again, the book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.